This is Audible.
British Legends, The Life and Legacy of King George III, written by Charles River Editors, narrated by Bill Hare. Introduction. George III, 1738-1820. I wish nothing but good. Therefore, everyone who does not agree with me is a traitor and a scoundrel. King George III. When he died in 1820, King George III had presided over the longest reign by a monarch in England's history, and ruled the British Empire during one of its most turbulent and important periods. But he was remembered by the unappealing sobriquets the Mad King and the King Who Lost America. The British remembered him based on the fact that he began suffering serious mental illnesses by the end of his life, and he was even more despised in America, with Jefferson summing up the public opinion of the British king in a letter to then-Ambassador John Adams, "We, I hope, shall be left free to avail ourselves of the advantages of neutrality, and yet much I fear the English, or rather their stupid king, will force us out of it. Common sense dictates, therefore, that they should let us remain neuter, ergo they will not let us remain neuter. I never yet found any other general rule for foretelling what they will do, but that of examining what they ought not to do." Given George III's descent into senility, and the fact that he was the monarch during the American Revolution, it was only natural that George III would be remembered those ways. But his reputation and legacy have been given a more objective and positive re-examination over the last few decades. The king played an important role in resisting the French in the aftermath of the French Revolution and the Napoleonic era, while charges of tyranny made by his opponents were naturally colored with bias and extreme exaggerations. Perhaps just as importantly, George III oversaw a period during which the monarch retained less and less power within the framework of the British Empire's constitutional monarchy, and thus ushered in a transformation in which the monarch went from wielding power to being a cultural figurehead. British Legends, The Life and Legacy of George III, looks at the life, reign, and legacy left by one of Britain's most important rulers. Chapter 1. Early Years. Born and educated in this country, I glory in the name of Britain. George III. On June 4, 1738, a prince was born, but it was not exactly a cause for celebration. Prince George was born about 2 months earlier than expected, and was therefore baptized immediately, as his parents and other royals feared the premature baby would die. As the son of Frederick, Prince of Wales, and grandson of King George II, the infant boy's death would have eliminated an heir to the throne, potentially creating a succession crisis if George II and Frederick died before Frederick had an heir. As fate would have it, the boy would actually end up living longer than any previous English monarch. Prince George was born to Frederick, Prince of Wales and heir apparent to the British throne, and Princess Augusta of Saxe-Gotha-Altenburg. Born in the Norfolk House in London, George's birth was unique for an heir apparent. Most of Britain's recent monarchs had not actually been born in England. Frederick, for example, was born in Hanover, Germany, as was King George II. The connection between the House of Hanover and the British Empire lasted for some time, and Prince George was part of this connection, but he would never actually head to Hanover himself. Like many royals and especially heirs to the throne, Prince George was educated by private tutors during his youth, but as a child he displayed characteristics that took his family by surprise. Prince George seemed unusually intelligent and showed an interest in contemporary events even before he was 10. But he was also quiet and very reserved. This concerned his family, particularly George II and Frederick, since a shy royal would have a harder time keeping the loyalty of his subjects. Nevertheless, the prince received a comprehensive education, including the relatively nascent fields of chemistry, physics, and astronomy. Born and bred in England, he spoke English as a first language, but also studied French and Latin, and the future king was also taught history, music, and law. The academics were rounded out by etiquette and sports, meant to ensure the boy was fit to be a king in every way. One somewhat ironic aspect of being afforded every luxury is that children born into European royalty were often kept at a distance from their families, and such was the case with Prince George's relationship with other members of the royal family, particularly the reigning monarch and his namesake, King George II. And there was no love lost between George II and his son Frederick. The young prince grew up seeing cold and often hostile relations between members of the royal family, which certainly placed a strain on his own outlook for his future as the monarch of Great Britain. The prince would later ruefully note, "I am born for the happiness or misery of a great nation, and consequently must often act contrary to my passions." The causes of Prince Frederick's hostile relations with his parents are unclear. Some speculate that the king's decision to make Prince Frederick the representative of the House of Hanover, and thus have him relocated to Hanover, was the cause of such hostility. By the early 18th century, England was the seat of global influence and power, not the House of Hanover, and Frederick may have seen his placement as something of a snub. As a young prince, Frederick also made a point of opposing the politics of his parents, which was increasingly troublesome. The king could not legitimately disinherit his heir, as such a move would upset Parliament and raise doubts in the monarchy as an institution, but he also could not tolerate his son's slander. King George II reportedly thought hard about a compromise, disinheriting Frederick only from the throne of Hanover and dividing Hanover from Great Britain. Frederick's poor relationship with his father trickled down to George III's relationship with his grandfather. Because of the king's poor relationship with his son, he likewise was distant and far removed from his grandson. Even when Frederick died prematurely and Prince George became the next in line, George II was reluctant to bestow upon him the title of Prince of Wales, the traditional title held by the British heir. Chapter 2. The Prince of Wales. The first 22 years of Prince George's life would see Britain dominated by his grandfather, King George II. George II's ascension to the throne, like that of his father, George I, was enveloped in the religious politics of the era. In the late 17th century, the House of Stuart, native to Great Britain, ruled the monarchies of England and Scotland. During the era, however, the Protestant Reformation had swept through the British Isles and had become entangled in the monarchy through King Henry VIII, who set the precedent that the monarch would play a critical role in the religion of the country. Following a civil war and significant strife, the nation decided on a dual monarchy of King William and Queen Mary. Thereafter, Queen Anne ascended to the throne, but issued no heir. After Anne, the next several heirs to the throne were all devout Roman Catholics. Parliament and the British people, now truly British, as a result of the Act of Union of 1707, detested the idea of continued religious controversy. The monarch, they thought, ought to remain forever Protestant and be the supreme head of the Anglican Church. Because of this, the Act of Settlement was passed, which prevented a Roman Catholic from ever assuming the throne. The result of the Act of Settlement was that the man who would succeed Queen Anne was a German from the House of Hanover, the Elector of Hanover, George I. George I was Protestant and thus eligible to assume the throne. King George II was also Protestant, but enveloped in as much controversy as his father. Due to the fact that they were German, George I and George II were never very popular in Britain, and George II's continued presence and trips to Hanover only hardened this impression. As a result of this distrust, the power of Parliament, now a hallmark of democracy, was augmented. The legislative body became the primary point of policy creation in the British Empire, and the monarchy lost a bit of its significance. Young George had taken an interest in the affairs of state and what was going on during his childhood, but as a kid he still figured it would be a while before he would succeed to the throne. While his grandfather was starting to age by 1751, the 13-year-old prince still had his father between him and the throne. That would change very suddenly, however. In his midlife, Prince Frederick had become an avid fan of cricket, a game that was proliferating throughout the British Isles, and he eventually became a national cricket star, attracting the interest of many of his father's subjects. This was helpful because it would ingratiate the German to his future British subjects. But it was not to be. While his father was already in his 60s, Frederick died unexpectedly in 1751 at his home in Britain. The likely cause of death was an abscess on his lung that erupted, and for a long time it was attributed to a blow from a cricket ball or some other sort of freak sporting injury, though that has never been substantiated. With the death of his father, Prince George now became next in line to the throne. He had an older brother through his father's first marriage, but that brother was raised Catholic through his mother, and was thus ineligible to inherit the throne. With that, King George II suddenly took more interest in his grandson, even as he was somewhat relieved that his son Frederick, with whom he had a deeply strained relationship, would never become king. The grandson that descended through that hostile son, however, was now poised to succeed him, so George II decided it was time to start grooming the young prince for the task. Frederick's death made other matters in George's life vitally important, particularly marriage and producing an heir. For his part, George was particularly interested in Lady Sarah Lennox, but the king and his own advisers thought she was unsuitable. The king preferred Duchess Sophie Caroline Marie of Brunswick, but George and his mother disagreed. The disagreement over the prince's marriage prospects would continue until George himself took the throne and needed to make a decision. By the mid-1750s, George II was treating his grandson like a proper heir, very much unlike the way he had treated his own son, Frederick. George II gave his grandson St. James's Palace, in addition to bestowing the proper title, Prince of Wales, upon his grandson, to go along with his inheritance of the title of Duke of Edinburgh. George II died suddenly in 1760, at the age of 77, but given his age, his death was not exactly unexpected, even though he had not experienced any extended illnesses and did not seem to be in imminent danger. His reign had been a fairly lengthy one, spanning more than 30 years. And the new king, George III, was just 22 years old. Chapter 3. The New King. At the young age of 22, George III was ready for his coronation on September 22, 1761, and so were the people. British citizens were generally thrilled with the new king's rise to power, viewing him as truly British, whereas George I and George II had been German kings, governing a British empire. George III, many thought, was the nation's first truly British monarch in quite a while, and they were excited about the prospects for change. To underscore his commitment to all things British, George III declared his love and attachment to Great Britain in his first speech on the throne, the opening session of George III's first Parliament. There he told the Parliament, "Born and educated in this country, I glory at the name of Britain." With this, George III signaled his love for Britain over Hanover, the first of his family to decisively declare such a sentiment. In fact, George III would spend almost all of his time in England, vacationing on the English coast instead of traveling abroad. Excitement over George III's coronation was intense. According to accounts of the day, carriages that brought well-wishers to Westminster Abbey crashed routinely along the route because the crowds were so congested, and George III had to be snuck into the abbey to avoid the large crowds. Once the crown was firmly resting on George III's head, a great roar of excitement rose out of the abbey and extended throughout the streets of London. No other king in recent history had been received with such enthusiasm. The nation was truly excited about the prospects for its very own British-born king, the first since the Act of Union in 1707, but the intensely high hopes also meant it would be increasingly challenging for George III to meet those high expectations. Furthermore, George III was coming to power in the middle of the Seven Years' War. But everything took a back seat to the new king taking a wife and producing heirs, and George III would move so quickly in marrying the German princess Charlotte of Mecklenburg-Strelitz that the two met on their wedding day. The search for a wife was a traditionally royal search, in that King George III's quest to find a suitable woman had nothing to do with love. Instead, it was thoroughly a political matter, and it was the new king's advisers who suggested Princess Charlotte, a young girl said to possess a fine mind and who would produce fine heirs. With that, the decision was made even before George III laid eyes upon her. He announced his decision to marry her in July 1761, quickly following on the heels of his grandfather's death. The time was ripe to produce excitement among the British people, since they were excited about George's recent ascension to the throne and were ready to revel in the joy of a royal marriage. On September 7, 1761, the date of the couple's marriage, George III and Charlotte met for the first time and were married by the Archbishop of Canterbury, Thomas Seeker, at St. James's Palace. Though their early marriage was not necessarily a happy one, it was never intended to be. Charlotte's only purpose was to produce an heir to the throne, and, in that sense, the marriage was successful when she gave birth to a boy within a year of their marriage, in August 1762. With the birth of George, Prince of Wales, the monarchy's succession was on firm footing. The Seven Years' War, begun under the reign of King George II, dominated the early years of King George III's reign, and it made governing Great Britain all the more difficult. Parliament may have welcomed the ascent of the new king, who was perceived to be British and would actively govern the nation, but King George II had involved the nation in a global war against the country's arch-nemesis, France, and the young and untested George III was forced to take up the war at a time when it had already divided Parliament and the nation over its course. Just 2 years into his reign, the Prime Minister was tossed out after parliamentary elections, and the Whig government under the Duke of Newcastle was replaced by a Tory government led by Scottish-born Lord Bute. Lord Bute was a close friend of George's family and one of his mother's trusted confidants, but he was enveloped in controversy during the final year of the war. As a Scotsman, John Stuart, the Earl of Bute, was the first ever Scottish-born Prime Minister to head a British government, which incited outrage among Englishmen who continued to hold anti-Scots sentiments and consider the Scots barbaric and uncivilized. Bute came to office as one of the most unpopular prime ministers in British history, even as he had a decent relationship with the king. All of this came at a critical moment, because Britain was on the verge of winning the Seven Years' War with France. The war had started going particularly well after George III came to the throne, with British forces pushing the French out of India and that subcontinent by the end of 1760, but the war expanded in 1762 with the entry of Spain and Portugal. Russia had been part of the war, but the reins of power were being passed upon the death of Catherine the Great, changing the direction for that country. The Seven Years' War was won primarily through attrition. All the nations involved had gone nearly bankrupt due to the cost of the world's first truly global war, and the ones who hit rock bottom first lost. Though Britain was not far behind them, the French had fallen into utter financial tumult and began peace negotiations in Paris in 1763. The war was ending, but the controversies in the British government were just heating up after Bute's government accepted the Treaty of Paris that year. The treaty realigned territorial holdings in Asia and North America in Britain's favor, but the British had the clear upper hand in the negotiations, with France literally unable to spend a single dime more to continue fighting. Thus, when Bute and King George III accepted a peace treaty that took less territory than some people would have preferred, there was dissension across Britain. France had been allowed to keep significant parts of its North American territory, despite losing its most populous region, Quebec, and Britons considered this a betrayal. At one point, rocks were thrown at King George III's carriage as he traveled through London, indicative of just how quickly the once popular king had fallen in the eyes of his subjects in just 3 years. While many viewed George III and Bute as having given too much to a fatally weakened France for little to no gain, they reasoned that taking too much from France would rouse the nation and its allies into another desperate war. Britain's position would be strengthened through an extended peace, in which it could recover from the costs of war more quickly and effectively than its enemies. That reasoning may have been sound in 1763, but events in North America would undermine it. Chapter 4. Problems with the American Colonies. One important result of the Seven Years' War was the proclamation of 1763, which limited British settlement in the western parts of the North American continent. This was done both to limit incursions into Native American territory, which would result in expensive wars, and also to limit the potential for further war with France. Bute resigned in 1763 and was replaced by a Whig, George Grenville, but concerns about the government being too conciliatory toward France would quickly go on the back burner as unrest grew in Britain's North American colonies, and George III would have to deal with a series of different prime ministers for the rest of the decade. From an early age, every American learns about the taxes and disputes that eventually led to war between Great Britain and her 13 colonies. The Sugar Act, the Stamp Act, the Boston Massacre, the Boston Tea Party, and the notion of no taxation without representation. Of course, the American narrative often ignores or overlooks why the British pursued the path that ultimately brought about the American Revolution. Although the Seven Years' War, known as the French and Indian War in the United States, was a crushing defeat for the French and a resounding success for Great Britain, the war itself put the kingdom deep in debt. To help alleviate the burden, Parliament soon began to pass a number of additional taxes to repay the nation's war debts. Many of the new taxes targeted the 13 colonies, and the logic for raising revenue in the colonies was clear. After all, the Seven Years' War had begun in North America, and a great deal of Britain's war expenses had gone toward supporting and defending the 13 colonies. Moreover, the 13 colonies were relatively untaxed by Great Britain compared to England, Scotland, and Wales. Finally, no member of Parliament represented the 13 colonies, so Parliament could increase taxes on the colonies without a great deal of parliamentary opposition or backlash among British citizens. This last fact, while convenient for Parliament, created a great deal of ill will in the 13 colonies. Many colonists believed that Parliament had no right to raise taxes when the colonies had no representation in Parliament, and they pointed to the fact that the King of England had long since surrendered any claim to raise taxes without the consent of the people's representatives in Parliament. A Parliament without a single American member, the colonists argued, could no more legally raise taxes on them than the King could on British citizens. Taxation without representation was, in the colonists' view, a violation of their rights as Englishmen. The first of these taxes was the Sugar Act of 1764, passed by Parliament on April 5, 1764. It had also been called the American Revenue Act, or Duties Act. An act for the better securing and encouraging the trade of His Majesty's sugar colonies in America, for applying the produce of such duties and of the duties to arise by virtue of the said act toward defraying the expenses of defending, protecting, and securing the said colonies and plantations, and for altering and disallowing several drawbacks on exports from this kingdom, and more effectually preventing the clandestine conveyance of goods to and from the said colonies and plantation, and improving and securing the trade between the same and Great Britain. The expenses of defending, protecting, and securing the said colonies and plantations refers to recent expenses Britain had incurred during the Seven Years' War. In the American colonies, the battles were primarily fought between the colonists and the French, who allied with the Native Americans in an attempt to establish dominion over disputed lands located along the borders between French and English colonies in Virginia, Nova Scotia, and Canada. The British sent armies to America to protect the farms and towns that were being threatened, and now they wanted the American colonies to help defray the cost of that protection. One of the oft-forgotten aspects of the British taxes on the colonies in the 1760s is that they were not terribly repressive. In fact, some of the British measures that were opposed by the colonists actually lowered the prices colonists paid for imported goods, including the Tea Act of 1773. The Sugar Act of 1764 was one of the British taxes that ostensibly lowered the price of imported goods, because it lowered the duty on molasses from 6 pence to 3, thereby replacing the duty imposed by the Molasses Act of 1733. New England merchants who imported barrels of molasses from the West Indies for the manufacture of rum had not protested the original Molasses Act of 1733's 6 pence duty 30 years earlier. Unsatisfied with the revenue it was gleaning from the Sugar Act, Grenville's government followed it with the Stamp Act of 1765, also known as the Duties in American Colonies Act of 1765. Unlike the Sugar Act, the Stamp Act was a direct tax that required many of the documents produced as part of the everyday legal and business activities of the colony to be printed on specially embossed and stamped paper only produced by the British government. Among the items required to bear this stamp were legal documents, newspapers, and magazines. To make matters worse, this paper could only be purchased with British sterling certificates, not the paper money used in the colonies. Since Parliament controlled the exchange rate, they also controlled how much each page actually cost. While the Sugar Act was something of a sullen undercurrent, the Stamp Act was a constant reminder of Parliament's power over the colonies, and it was almost certainly designed as a show of force of sorts by Parliament. Whereas they had for more than a century considered themselves to be good Englishmen with the same rights and duties as any other loyal subject, they now saw themselves as something akin to unloved stepchildren, tolerated, provided for, and disciplined, but without the same rights as the other English citizens. In 1765, the Stamp Act Congress met in New York City. Called by James Otis, Jr., it met in New York during the middle 2 weeks of October that year and was comprised of representatives from all 13 colonies. The Congress was tasked with appealing to Great Britain for some sort of relief, either in the form of the Sugar and Stamp Act being repealed, or the American colonies being represented in Parliament. In the end, they produced a Declaration of Rights and Grievances to the King that read, in part, "Whereas, since the close of the last year, the British Parliament, claiming a power of right to bind the people of America by statute in all cases whatsoever, hath in some acts expressly imposed taxes on them, and in others, under various pretenses, but in fact for the purpose of raising a revenue, hath imposed rates and duties payable in these colonies, established a board of commissioners with unconstitutional powers, and extended the jurisdiction of courts of admiralty not only for collecting the said duties, but for the trial of causes merely arising within the body of a county. And whereas assemblies have been frequently dissolved contrary to the rights of the people when they attempted to deliberate on grievances, and their dutiful, humble, loyal, and reasonable petitions to the Crown for redress have been repeatedly treated with contempt by His Majesty's Ministers of State, the good people of the several colonies, justly alarmed at these arbitrary proceedings of Parliament and administration, have severally elected, constituted, and appointed deputies to meet and sit in General Congress in the city of Philadelphia in order to obtain such establishment as that their religion, laws, and liberties may not be subverted. Whereupon the deputies so appointed, being now assembled in a full and free representation of these colonies, taking into their most serious consideration the best means of attaining the ends aforesaid, do in the first place, as Englishmen, their ancestors in like cases have usually done, for asserting and vindicating their rights and liberties, declare that the inhabitants of the English colonies of North America, by the immutable laws of nature, the principles of the English Constitution, and the several charters or compacts, have the following rights. 1. That all are entitled to life, liberty, and property, and they have never ceded to any sovereign power whatever a right to dispose of either without their consent. All and each of which the aforesaid deputies in behalf of themselves and their constituents do claim, demand, and insist upon, as their indubitable rights and liberties, which cannot be legally taken from them, altered or abridged by any power whatever, without their own consent, by their representatives in their several provincial legislatures. As events were unfolding and causing troubles in North America, George III was left to deal with Grenville, who was not only taking a hard line with the colonies, but also opposing many of the king's preferred policies. After failing to persuade William Pitt the Elder to replace Grenville, George III replaced him with a different Whig, Lord Rockingham. Lord Rockingham would relent on Grenville's Stamp Act, but he had other plans in mind for the American colonies. Not surprisingly, Parliament was not pleased with the colonists' complaints, nor were they about to let a small group of subjects on the other side of the Atlantic deny them what they considered to be their rightful income. So, while they repealed the taxes, they also passed the Declaratory Act, primarily in response to the Stamp Congress's Declaration of Rights and Grievances. An act for the better securing the dependency of His Majesty's dominions in America upon the Crown and Parliament of Great Britain. Whereas several of the Houses of Representatives in His Majesty's colonies and plantations in America have of late, against law, claimed to themselves or to the General Assemblies of the same, the sole and exclusive right of imposing duties and taxes upon His Majesty's subjects in the said colonies and plantations, and have, in pursuance of such claim, passed certain votes, resolutions, and orders derogatory to the legislative authority of Parliament, and inconsistent with the dependency of the said colonies and plantations upon the Crown of Great Britain, it may be declared that the said colonies and plantations in America have been, are, and of right ought to be, subordinate unto and dependent upon the Imperial Crown and Parliament of Great Britain, and that the King's Majesty, by and with the advice and consent of the Lords Spiritual and Temporal and Commons of Great Britain, in Parliament assembled, had, hath, and of right ought to have full power and authority to make laws and statutes of sufficient force and validity to bind the colonies and people of America, subjects of the Crown of Great Britain, in all cases whatsoever. 2. And be it further declared and enacted by the authority aforesaid that all resolutions, votes, orders, and proceedings in any of the said colonies or plantations, whereby the power and authority of the Parliament of Great Britain to make laws and statutes as aforesaid is denied or drawn into question, are and are hereby declared to be utterly null and void to all intents and purposes whatsoever. With these words, Parliament made it clear that they had no intention of budging on any issue of concern to the colonists. They further made the first steps toward forcing the issue of American dependence or independence. Things from this point on would have to go one way or the other. To emphasize their determination to remain in charge, Rockingham's government quickly passed the Revenue Act of 1766, which reduced the tax on molasses to a penny a gallon, but applied it to all molasses imports of any kind, be they British or from elsewhere. The following year, they added the Townshend Acts, which taxed glass, lead, paint, paper, and, perhaps worst of all, tea. In addition to the taxing acts, Parliament also passed the Quartering Act of 1765, which obliged citizens in the colonies to quarter British soldiers in inns, barns, or public houses. The purpose of this act was to defray some of the costs of keeping nearly 10,000 British regulars in the colonies permanently after the Seven Years' War. Parliament assumed that the colonial assemblies would construct barracks at their own expense to prevent troops being quartered on private property, but that did not happen. Even as Rockingham's government was taking a hard line against the colonies, his government was weak internally, and George III got his way by replacing him with Pitt the Elder in 1766. But the Whigs would continue to struggle on both sides of the Atlantic until the Tories finally took power again in 1770, and Lord North became Prime Minister. Meanwhile, in response to the Townshend Acts, the American colonists continued to organize boycotts against the items being taxed. So one saw more and more houses on the street with broken windows boarded up instead of replaced, Rather than seen as a sign of negligence, this was viewed by the neighbors as a sign of patriotism and rebellion against unjust taxes. Likewise, new homes were left unpainted or whitewashed with a mixture of lime and water, while letters were written on the backs of other letters, or even on tree bark, rather than taxable paper. At the beginning of 1770, it looked like everything might be resolved peacefully. Parliament, realizing that they weren't going to make any money on items the colonists refused to buy, rescinded most of the Townshend Acts, leaving only the tax on tea in place. For his part, George III wanted to limit taxes so as to assuage the Americans, but he did not want to repeal them all. He agreed Parliament had the right to tax colonies, and wanted to make that point by leaving the tax on tea, the most profitable of the taxes, in place. As George III himself put it, he wanted one tax to keep up the right to continue levying taxes. The colonists, feeling that they had made their point, called off the boycotts and returned to buying British goods. Within a few months, the British had removed two of the regiments stationed in Boston. However, instead of improving the situation, this placed more strain on those left behind and led to increasing tensions between the soldiers and the colonists. On the evening of March 5th, 1770, a teenager insulted a British officer regarding an overdue payment owed to the shop he was an apprentice at. British soldier Private Hugh White, who was standing guard outside the customs house on King Street, told the teenager to be more respectful. When the teenager began insulting White, White struck him across the head with the butt of his musket. Infuriated by White's assault, a larger group of Bostonians began crowding White and threatening him as he took up a defensive position on the steps of the custom house. A handful of British soldiers, bayonets fixed, marched to the customs house to protect White, and these soldiers found themselves confronted by a mob of hundreds of Bostonians, taunting the soldiers and throwing snowballs at them. When one object hit British soldier Private Montgomery, he got back to his feet, shouted, "Damn you, fire!" and fired into the crowd, stunning everyone and nearly killing his own captain, Thomas Preston. With that, several British soldiers began firing into the crowd as well, despite not being ordered to, killing or mortally wounding 5 people. While the British authorities promised to hold an investigation, and the soldiers on the scene were arrested and later tried, the race was on for the Sons of Liberty to memorialize the event. While different portrayals of the event made their way into newspapers, patriot papers accused the British of committing a massacre designed to quell a spirit of liberty. Though the British eventually removed more soldiers from Boston, the primary complaint the colonists had, the damage had already been done. Shortly after the Boston Massacre, Samuel Adams and his allies organized a group of committees of correspondence. In each town, a group of men would be chosen to consult together over the current political situation and then to communicate their thoughts to others in the colony via messenger. The system worked so well in Massachusetts that other colonies soon followed suit. The colonies' committees eventually began coordinating responses to British acts with one another, forming the first political bonds between separate colonies. And they would be the bodies that brought about the first Continental Congress in the summer of 1774. Another crisis arose with Parliament's passage of the Tea Act in 1773. The Tea Act was designed to shore up the East India Company, one of Britain's most important commercial interests, by giving the company the right to sell directly to the colonies without having to go through the brokers that other companies did, creating potential for serious economic misfortune for colonial tea merchants. This action cut colonial merchants out of the company's supply chain and undercut the price of smuggled Dutch tea. Despite rumors to the contrary, the colonists were not as angry about the cost of the tax on the tea as they were the tax itself. In fact, the tea being brought in would be less expensive than that being sold. The problem was that Parliament was once again taking it upon itself to regulate colonial trade without the colonists' permission, and they felt that if they purchased the cheaper tea being offered, they were in effect giving in to parliamentary rule. As the tea ship Dartmouth arrived in Boston Harbor in late November, Paul Revere and Dr. Joseph Warren organized the North End Caucus to make sure that the tea would not be unloaded. The royal governor, Thomas Hutchinson, publicly declared that if the rebels, as they were pleased to style the Bostonians, should not withdraw their opposition to the landing of the tea before a certain day, the 17th day of December, 1773, they should on that day force it on shore under the cover of their cannon's mouth. With Governor Hutchinson refusing to allow the Dartmouth or the other two ships that soon joined it to leave without paying the prescribed import duty, the standoff continued until December 16th, the day before Hutchinson's deadline to unload the tea. Instead of reaching some sort of agreement, the colonists took matters into their own hands, literally, by dumping the tea into Boston Harbor. As the report from the Boston Gazette indicates, the full ramifications and importance of the Boston Tea Party were not immediately clear, as evidenced by the rather short shrift given to the act itself. On Tuesday last, the body of the people of this and all the adjacent towns and others from the distance of 20 miles assembled in the Old South Meeting House to inquire the reason of the delay in sending the ship Dartmouth with the East India tea back to London, and having found that the owner had not taken the necessary steps for that purpose, they enjoined him at his peril to demand of the collector of the customs a clearance for the ship, and appointed a committee of 10 to see it performed, after which they adjourned to the Thursday following 10 o'clock. They then met, and being informed by Mr. Roach that a clearance was refused him, they enjoined him immediately to enter a protest and apply to the governor for a passport by the castle, and adjourned again till 3 o'clock for the same day, at which time they again met, and after waiting till near sunset, Mr. Roach came in and informed them that he had accordingly entered his protest and waited on the governor for a pass, but His Excellency told him he could not, consistent with his duty, grant it until his vessel was qualified. The people, finding all their efforts to preserve the property of the East India Company and return it safely to London frustrated by the sea consignees, the collector of the customs, and the governor of the province, dissolved their meeting. But behold what followed. A number of brave and resolute men, determined to do all in their power to save their country from the ruin which their enemies had plotted, in less than 4 hours emptied every chest of tea on board the three ships commanded by the captains Hall, Bruce, and Coffin, amounting to 342 chests, into the sea, without the least damage done to the ships or any other property. The matter and owners are well pleased that their ships are thus cleared, and the people are almost universally congratulating each other on this happy event. The Boston Tea Party outraged Lord North's government and the king. As historian Peter North noted, George III's hopes were centered on a political solution, and he always bowed to his cabinet's opinions even when skeptical of their success. The detailed evidence of the years from 1763 to 1775 tends to exonerate George III from any real responsibility for the American Revolution. Infuriated by the Tea Party, the British Parliament passed a new set of stringent and punitive laws, known collectively as the Coercive Acts. The first of these closed the port of Boston to both going and coming ships, in effect crippling the city's economy until the city repaid the merchants for their lost tea. The second basically invalidated the Massachusetts Charter and gave Parliament the right to appoint colonial officials previously elected by their peers. Next, the Administration of Justice Act authorized judges to remove any colonist charged with a crime to another colony, or even Great Britain, for trial. The final and most severe blow, however, came when Governor Hutchinson was removed and replaced with General Thomas Gage, commander of the British forces in America, placing the city under unofficial martial law. With the Coercive or Intolerable Acts of 1774, Parliament hoped the punitive measures would compel the colonies to stop resisting parliamentary authority. Like the other attempts, however, this one only had the opposite effect, with many colonists viewing the acts as an arbitrary violation of their rights. Beginning on September 5, 1774, in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, the First Continental Congress started meeting. Its ultimate aim was, of course, respect for North American constitutional rights to representation in Parliament. Meeting in Carpenter's Hall, where Pennsylvania's Congress met, the delegates aimed to show a united force and authority toward Great Britain. But from the beginning, this would be tough to accomplish because the different colonies had different priorities. For example, Pennsylvania and New York sent delegates with instructions to seek a cordial and respectful solution with the British, while others advocated separation between their colony and Britain. Some of the colonies had men with far different views. For example, Virginia's delegates included statesmen like George Washington and Richard Henry Lee, but also included the more fiery Patrick Henry. Furthermore, the objectives of the Congress weren't entirely set out ahead of time, leaving the body to quickly form a leadership and figure out a core set of tasks to carry out. The first few weeks consisted mostly of discussing and debating the issues, and Joseph Galloway of Pennsylvania came up with the first plan. A plan of union of Great Britain and the colonies, which suggested a popularly elected Grand Council among all of the colonies that would be their equivalent of a parliament. This would eventually be undone by the delegates arriving from Boston, whose ongoing troubles with the British made them much more pessimistic about an effort at conciliation. On October 14th, the Declaration and Resolves established the Congress's Statement of Principles, which they considered as common principles for all of the colonies. It was also on this day that Congress voted to meet again the following year if these grievances were not attended to by England. Once that body convened, however, its purpose proved to be very different. Chapter 5. The American Revolution. He has abdicated government here. He has plundered our seas, ravaged our coasts, burnt our towns, and destroyed the lives of our people. The Declaration of Independence. In early 1775, General Thomas Gage, the military commander in charge of Boston, heard that colonists were keeping a store of weapons near Concord, Massachusetts. Gage made plans to send out a force of about 700 British soldiers to seize the weapons on the morning of April 19, 1775. However, Patriot leaders in Boston got news of the planned raid the day before, and Paul Revere and other riders alerted the militias of Lexington and Concord during the night before, hours in advance of the marching British. By the time the British regulars reached Lexington, a small party of the local militia met the British regulars on the village green. It's unclear who fired first, but either way, shots were exchanged. While a handful of militiamen lay wounded or dying, the British continued on toward Concord, where they encountered far more organized resistance. As militiamen swarmed toward the action from neighboring towns and villages, the British forces began the march back to Boston, coming under fire along the road. By the time the British made it back to the safety of Boston, thousands of militiamen had surrounded the city, beginning what would become a nearly year-long siege. The American Revolution had officially begun, and George III would now be faced with one of the British Empire's biggest crises. One of its colonies was in open revolt, and the demands of this revolt, and what would become of them, were not known by either side in 1775. At the same time, the news traveled at a much slower pace in the 18th century, and it would take weeks for news of Lexington and Concord to reach England, giving the colonists much-needed time to coordinate their strategy. Conveniently, the Second Continental Congress was scheduled to meet in May, just 2 weeks after the battles in Massachusetts. Originally charged with coordinating a boycott of British exports, the legislative body now had much more pressing issues to resolve. The Second Continental Congress opened on May 10th, 1775, again in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. All of the Assembly's original agenda was scrapped and immediately replaced by more relevant issues. How to create and fund an army to expel British troops from North America and garner the respect the colonies deserved. The Massachusetts Provincial Congress, an illegal body specifically banned by the Massachusetts Act, had already begun coordinating town militias into a single colony-wide army. The Continental Congress again followed Massachusetts's lead and authorized the creation of the Continental Army on June 14, 1775. The original Continental Army was relatively small and consisted primarily of local militias brought together by the Massachusetts Provincial Congress. The colony's 22,000 troops joined some 5,000 troops from New York to make the beginnings of the Continental Army. Congress, meanwhile, commissioned the creation of money to fund additional one-year enlistments from other colonies. Unlike the first Continental Congress, the second intended to assume the role of government in the 13 colonies. It created an army, established the printing of currency, and even sent foreign diplomats to begin negotiating with other nations. This was no body concerned with coordinating a protest movement. Instead, it would be a full-fledged, if somewhat impotent, governing body. Despite its assumption of governing duties, the Second Continental Congress never intended, at least initially, to become the governing body of a new nation. Instead, it merely hoped to transform the relationship between Britain and her colonies to allow for greater self-government on their side of the Atlantic. Separation between the two was rarely favored. This initial sentiment coalesced into the Olive Branch petition. John Dickinson, a delegate from Delaware, convinced the other delegates that a reasonable motion of reconciliation between George III and his colonies was the best path forward. Legitimate discussions on their differences would likely lead to an agreeable solution. Dickinson, like many colonists at the time, considered himself a proud British subject whose differences were primarily with Parliament, not the fundamental ideals of constitution and liberty that defined the Anglosphere. The Second Continental Congress approved of Dickinson's motion, and Virginia delegate Thomas Jefferson drafted the resolution, known as the Olive Branch Petition. While the petition passed overwhelmingly in Congress, not all delegates approved. This was especially true in Massachusetts, the hotbed of colonial rebellion. There, delegates like John Adams and John Hancock thought that war and permanent separation were now inevitable. Having seen action on the ground in their home colony, they doubted that peaceful coexistence could ever again be established. Regardless, though, these separatists from Massachusetts were quiet during the Olive Branch petition. They privately acknowledged that separation was the most likely scenario, but also recognized that popular sentiment toward such a radical position would require an impetus. Until that moment of ignition was apparent, the Massachusetts delegation decided to go along with pleas for reconciliation. Dickinson sent the letter on July 8, 1775. He hoped that with the battles of Lexington and Concord behind them, the king would see legitimate reason to avoid bloodshed and negotiate with the colonists. Delegate John Adams of Massachusetts, however, thought otherwise and wrote a letter to a friend detailing why the colonists would continue war with Britain and eventually demand independence. Royal officials intercepted this letter and sent it to the king alongside the Olive Branch petition. With both documents in hand, the king decided the petition was insincere, and he was so insulted by the document that he declared the American colonies in a state of rebellion, allowing anyone to be tried for treason. Congress's hopes for reconciliation were lost, and attempts to gain support in other North American colonies for peace also failed. From the beginning, the king thought the ultimate goal, though unstated, of the colonists was to create what he thought of as an independent empire. In his speech from the throne at the opening of Parliament in 1775, the king told Parliament of this intention, and that he did not consider rebellious American colonists to be loyal to him or Great Britain. Suppressing the rebellion was a top priority. George III took such a rigid stance that he has long been accused of insisting that the British fight the revolution when others counseled against it. Victorian author George Trevelyan characterized the king's policies as being determined never to acknowledge the independence of the Americans and to punish their contumacy by the indefinite prolongation of a war which promised to be eternal. He further accused George III of wanting to keep the rebels harassed, anxious, and poor until the day when, by a natural and inevitable process, discontent and disappointment were converted into penitence and remorse. At the same time, however, no British king would have taken a conciliatory stance that resulted in the independence of all 13 colonies. An estimated 50% of the colonists were still loyalists, and the Tories in power during Lord North's government also favored prosecuting the war. Immediately after the battles of Lexington and Concord on April 19, 1775, the militiamen who had poured in from across the countryside converged on Boston, which at the time was a peninsula with a small neck attaching it to the rest of Massachusetts. With the Charles River surrounding it on three sides, Boston was an ideal city to lay siege to. The militias blocked off the land approaches to Boston. But when 4,500 more British soldiers arrived by sea, the American forces fell back to adjacent hills on the Charlestown Peninsula, Breed's Hill and Bunker Hill. At this time, the colonists and colonial forces were still unclear of their ultimate goals. The Second Continental Congress would not formally declare independence for another year. During the first few months of the fighting, the British tried on several occasions to lift the siege by force. The strongest attempt took place in June, when the British fired on Charlestown and then landed 3,000 British regulars on the peninsula. This attempt, which came to be known as the Battle of Bunker Hill, would end up being the bloodiest battle of the war. On June 17, 1775, 3,000 British soldiers attempted multiple charges up Bunker Hill against 1,200 defenders who were fairly well entrenched. The third attempt forced the colonists back to Cambridge, but the British suffered a heavy price, with over 1,000 British soldiers killed or wounded, compared to only 450 casualties for the colonists. The Battle of Bunker Hill was technically a tactical victory for the British, but it did not break the siege of Boston, and it provided a morale boost for the colonial forces. General Gage was replaced by General Howe as commander of the British forces, and the siege would continue until the British quit Boston in March 1776, nearly 11 whole months after the first shots were fired. After Washington had forced the British to quit Boston and began marching his men toward New York City, the American colonies were euphoric over their astounding victory. Meanwhile, a young American of British origin named Thomas Paine penned a well-publicized pamphlet called simply Common Sense. The pamphlet, at less than 50 pages, articulated the state of the American-British conflict by 1776 and deduced the rational path forward. Paine, a strong follower of Enlightenment egalitarianism, examined the history of British democracy, concluding that its model was noble but horribly imperfect. America, Paine thought, could do better. By April of 1776, talk had heated up concerning independence, and a consensus was quickly growing in Congress. However, one problem was in the way. Did the Congress have the authority to declare independence for its 13-member colonies? The process was riddled with confusion across the colonies. Some, such as North Carolina, had sent explicit instructions to their congressional delegation to support independence, suggesting Congress has the authority. Others, such as Rhode Island and New Hampshire, declared independence directly and unilaterally, suggesting individual colonies had the authority. Elsewhere in Massachusetts and New York, even individual towns and cities sent declarations of independence to King George III. The royal mailbox was packed with letters declaring colonial independence. As a document, the Declaration of Independence justified the call for independence by listing grievances against the king and anchoring them with natural and legal rights, which formed the most memorable lines in the document. In addition to summarizing Jefferson's political philosophy, the Declaration was an amalgamation of the words and thoughts of famous political philosophers of the previous century, including Montesquieu and John Locke. Regardless, Jefferson is now remembered as the author of one of the English language's most timeless passages, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, and that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." Among the most controversial articles was a statement that blamed the existence of slavery on the British crown. It read as follows: "He has waged cruel war against human nature itself, violating its most sacred rights of life and liberty in the persons of a distant people who never offended him, captivating and carrying them into slavery in another hemisphere, or to incur miserable death in their transportation thither. This piratical warfare, the opprobrium of infidel powers, is the warfare of the Christian King of Great Britain. Determined to keep open a market where men should be bought and sold, he has prostituted his negative for suppressing every legislative attempt to prohibit or restrain this execrable commerce. This passage ignited outrage among the congressional delegates. Southerners who supported slavery thought the language too strong. Northern merchants who profited from the slave trade agreed. The general sentiment also held that the passage would alienate moderate Britons from supporting the revolution. Ultimately, the passage was voted down and replaced with a more moderate line about the king's ignition of war among us. George Washington is perhaps the most famous American in history and is viewed as his country's greatest revolutionary hero. But he and his Continental Army had a terrible year after the British evacuated Boston in March 1776. At the end of 1776, the American war effort was on the verge of collapse, and despite Washington's success at Trenton, the British were confident that they could quell the rebellion in 1777. That winter, the British planned a complicated campaign in which British armies from Canada and New York would strike out across New England and link up, with the goal of cutting off the northern colonies. Indeed, 1777 did prove to be the pivotal year of the war, but not in the way the British intended. The British planned a three-pronged sweep through the northern colonies that would eventually end with the linking up of three different forces. The design of the plan called for the capture of Philadelphia, as well as the colony of New York, and it aimed to all but slice the rebellious colonies in two. Instead, the campaign ended disastrously, with the decisive defeat at Saratoga. In December 1776, Benjamin Franklin was sent by Congress to France to attempt to secure a critically needed alliance. Franklin was an ideal choice for Enlightenment France, which revered Franklin for his scientific accomplishments and his known reputation as a brilliant man. Franklin had also been a diplomat before the Revolution, spending several years in London on behalf of the colonies. However, the French refused to provide more than arms and money throughout 1777 until they learned in December 1777 about Saratoga and Burgoyne's surrender. With that news, French King Louis XVI entered into a formal military alliance with the United States, and in February 1778 France joined the war. Despite the loss at Saratoga, British enthusiasm for the war actually increased, but this was extinguished when the American Revolution essentially threatened to become a repeat of the Seven Years' War, when France entered the conflict on behalf of the Americans. British outrage over the continued and costly war ensued, and riots broke out in London. Things were only about to get worse. Prior to its formally entering the war, France had provided substantial support to the American cause. In particular, France had sold and given supplies to the Continental Army. Most important of these supplies was gunpowder. There was very little capacity for manufacturing gunpowder in the 13 colonies, and outside of seizing British supplies, the colonial forces had no choice but to import gunpowder from France. France's entry into the war dramatically altered the strategic balance. The war became a global war, with much of Great Britain's possessions threatened. As a result, Great Britain was forced to spend more resources outside of the American theater. British strategy had to change to accommodate a global war. Great Britain had to protect its colonies in the West Indies, India, and even guard against a potential French invasion of Ireland. French participation also had an immediate effect on Great Britain's North American strategy. Prior to France's entry, Great Britain could move troops and supplies by sea with only minimal threat from American privateers. But France had a powerful navy that could threaten British troop movements and attack British-held towns from the sea. Thus, the British shifted their strategy to try to subdue the South. But after several victories from 1778 to 1780, the British effort to subdue the southern colonies began to fail. A series of battles with American forces began to weaken the British, even though the British repeatedly forced the Americans to retreat. After the Battle of King's Mountain, in present-day eastern Tennessee, various guerrilla units linked up with organized American armies, led by Major General Nathaniel Greene and Brigadier General Daniel Morgan. Morgan and Greene pushed the British general northward into Virginia, where Cornwallis chose to encamp in the Yorktown Peninsula in March of 1781. The British began to fortify Yorktown on the York River. The York River was navigable for the British Navy, and the British hoped to be able to resupply the southern theater of war from Yorktown. Washington and his men had stayed in the northern colonies throughout that time, but he decided in 1781 to coordinate movements south with the French toward Virginia. Washington's American forces and allied French troops combined north of New York City and feinted movement toward it to freeze the British in place before turning the army south to Virginia. When Washington arrived in Yorktown, the combined American and French forces totally surrounded the town. After an extensive bombardment, the combined attack claimed the British defenses. With the French and American artillery shelling Yorktown from three sides, General Cornwallis was forced to surrender. Over 7,000 British officers and soldiers were captured, and the battle was the last major battle in North America, thus effectively ensuring the independence of the United States. Just 13 days later, Cornwallis surrendered to Washington, handing him his sword. It is said that the British regimental band, recognizing the gravity of their defeat, played a popular tune of the time called "The World Turned Upside Down." And upside down the world was. A nation so young it barely existed, only in the eyes of France did it really exist, had defeated the most powerful military in the world. When news of Yorktown reached London near the end of 1781, popular support for the war plummeted. Before fighting resumed in 1782, Parliament had undergone a shift in power that stressed making peace, and in April 1782, the House of Commons voted to end the war. As a result, the fighting in North America ended. However, the British would continue to fight the French in Europe and the West Indies until the Treaty of Paris was signed in 1783, ending all hostilities. The British also signed separate treaties with France and Spain at that time. The most ironic aspect of the Treaty of Paris is that despite helping turn the tide of the Revolution, and despite the fact that the treaty was negotiated in its capital, the French ended up playing a relatively limited role in negotiating the treaty. Unbeknownst to the French, shortly after Yorktown, the British and Americans began conducting secret negotiations between themselves. While the Americans thought that John Adams would make a good negotiator to begin the long process of brokering peace with England, the French were not so sure. They insisted that the American government send other men, whom they found more socially acceptable, to join the staid Adams. To that end, the tactful John Jay joined Franklin and Adams in France, and together the three tried to open negotiations. However, Jay and Adams soon realized that the French were not that keen on having America reunite with their perpetual enemy. It became apparent that whenever a French minister became involved in the process, negotiations slowed and even stalled entirely. Against the advice of Franklin, the two men circumvented the French and began talking directly to the British commissioners. Thus, the American delegation in France waited until the British and Americans had resolved much of their peace terms before informing the French. France was irate once it realized what the Americans had done, even with Franklin trying to soothe nerves and spin the events like a political operative. But by then it was too late for the French. Despite indebting themselves to the tune of the modern-day equivalent of hundreds of billions of dollars, France wielded almost no control over the terms of the peace. The United States and Britain reached an impressively comprehensive peace in the Treaty of Paris. Among the important terms of the treaty, Britain recognized the colonies as free and relinquished territorial claims to them. The two sides then negotiated the boundaries that separated the United States from the British colonies in present-day Canada. Additionally, the British and Americans strove to share certain waters, including the Mississippi River and the fishing waters off Newfoundland. Finally, the two sides made mutual promises regarding paying debts and returning property that had been confiscated during the war, including slaves. Still, the Treaty of Paris was not without its problems. Almost immediately, individual states in America rejected certain provisions and ignored them outright. A hallmark characteristic of American federalism that would lead to the Civil War 80 years later. Other problems included disputes along the boundary with Canada and the fact that American access to the Mississippi River was blocked after the British and Spanish signed a separate treaty that left Spain in control of Florida. Some of these problems would fester heading into the 19th century, and eventually the British and Americans would go to war again in 1812. The Treaty of Paris also had other geopolitical consequences. By ostensibly reconciling with the British, the Americans and French all but broke off their alliance, leaving Britain as America's natural trade partner. The choice between France and Britain divided the colonists. The Federalists viewed Britain as more valuable a trading partner, while Jefferson's camp identified with the French. The first political divisions between the men who would become Federalists and the men who would become Democratic Republicans were already forming before the United States was even recognized. This was a welcome surprise for George III, who told Adams, "I was the last to consent to the separation, but the separation having been made and having become inevitable, I have always said, as I say now, that I would be the first to meet the friendship of the United States as an independent power." The United States and France would not be allies again for another 130 years. Chapter 6. Troubles. King George III had always had a difficult relationship with his prime ministers. This was no different during the American crisis, when Lord North served as the head of British government and directed much of the political maneuvering necessary to end the American Revolution on positive terms. This, however, made him deeply unpopular, and when the war was lost in the early 1780s, so too was Lord North's political career. George III had long preferred the support of Lord North and detested his resignation, even initially rejecting North's resignation during the Revolution, even as Parliament was increasingly unhappy with the Prime Minister and wanted him ousted. By a motion of no confidence, North became, in 1782, the first Prime Minister to be forced out of office by an Act of Parliament. Parliament had increased its powers over the King once more. In the years after North's fall, King George III oversaw two other Prime Ministers, William Petty, the Earl of Sherborne, and William Cavendish, Duke of Portland. But due to these appointments, much controversy ensued between the King and his Parliament. With North, the Parliament asserted that it had a legitimate right to dismiss the Prime Minister, but through his appointments the King asserted that it was actually his right to make such an appointment. The British Constitution, as usual, was unclear, and a struggle ensued between the two sides. A clear majority in Parliament within just a few years of North's demise was opposed to King George III and wanted a Prime Minister hostile to his policies. Instead, King George III himself appointed a Prime Minister without the advice of parliamentarian majority. 24-year-old William Pitt the Younger. The House of Commons quickly passed a motion of no confidence, but unlike Lord North before him, Pitt refused to resign, citing the backing of the King. Furthermore, the constitutional waters became even murkier when the House of Lords passed motions supporting Pitt's ministry. By 1783, Parliament was dismissed and new elections were held. Pitt was overwhelmingly supported by the people of Great Britain, the King, and the House of Lords, and together they made sure that Pitt remained as Prime Minister. With the matter settled that year, George III had reasserted some of his authority over the Parliament, specifically the House of Commons, and he enjoyed newfound popularity among his subjects. Unfortunately, George III would not have long to utilize his popularity. A few years later, in 1788, the King lapsed into an extended period of mental illness, during which he seemed to be almost completely incoherent. Naturally, this left many worried about his ability to continue ruling as King, and a regent, his son, was appointed to serve in his mental absence. Later in the decade, his symptoms worsened, to the extent that later unsubstantiated reports claimed he was mistaking trees for Prussian kings and babbling incoherently like a madman for hours on end. What is known is that he was producing urine that was tinged with hints of red and blue, and sometimes he foamed at the mouth. His aides were very worried and naturally attempted to keep the illness hidden from both the public and Parliament. It is now believed that George III had a similar bout of mental derangement during the early years of his reign in 1762, which left him completely incoherent for about a week. In his second bout, in 1788, however, mental deterioration lasted considerably longer, to the point that some thought it was permanent. After a few months, however, George III somehow lapsed out of the condition, leaving doctors all the more baffled. The exact cause of George's infrequent but severe outbursts of mental disorder is not entirely clear. Many doctors and historians suggest that a hereditary blood disease known as porphyria, which prevents the proper breakdown of proteins, was the cause of his outbursts. Not properly treating the disease can lead to severe mental deterioration with symptoms similar to those experienced by the king, and little was known about mental illness at the time. Others suggest that George's condition was worsened by the medical treatments of the day, which included administering arsenic. Now known to be a poisonous substance, the compound may have further impacted the king's mental state. Arsenic, in high and dangerous levels, were found in strands of the king's hair that were examined in more modern times. Whatever the cause of George's mental collapses, a regent was needed to rule the kingdom during the king's mental absence, sparking yet another controversy. Some members of Parliament believed it was the sole right of the monarch himself to appoint a regent, but others thought Parliament had a say in the matter. Both Prime Minister Pitt and former Prime Minister Fox agreed that Prince George, heir to the throne, ought to serve as regent. They disagreed, however, over how the prince ought to be certified as regent. Being the man currently in power, Prime Minister Pitt was able to pass a bill, the Regency Act, that certified Prince George as regent, setting yet another precedent in the ongoing feud between Parliament and its king. The Prince of Wales served as regent for only a few months, after which George III recovered from his severe mental condition. But in the interim, the situation in France had turned sour. The French Revolution had erupted in 1789, and out of this came a serious concern across Europe, where many worried that revolutionary fervor would topple monarchs across the continent and possibly in Great Britain itself. The parliamentarian struggle with George III underlined a broader conflict within the country. Aristocrats in the House of Lords had long questioned whether the king and rule by monarchy was proper for Britain, arguing on the contrary that the empire ought to be more heavily influenced by aristocrats. Revolution in France, however, united the king and the nobility, out of fear that a revolution of the type seen in France would cast them both aside at the same time. At home, George III quickly collaborated with Prime Minister Pitt to organize a strong and assertive opposition to anyone within Britain who might challenge the stability of government there. This included most significantly the passage of the Second Act of Union, which fully incorporated majority Catholic Ireland into the realm of the empire, and overnight the nation became the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland. With the addition of Catholics, however, came a quandary. Should they be allotted the rights that were afforded Protestant citizens? To this the king adamantly believed they should not. Chapter 7. The Napoleonic Wars. As Ireland was being suppressed at home, war between France and the United Kingdom broke out for a third time in less than half a century. This time, however, France was renewed with leadership in the form of Napoleon, a powerful military general intent on conquering much of mainland Europe. To do so would invite imbalance in the balance of power on the continent, and this the king could not accept. Napoleon's dream of invading Britain itself was destroyed by Horatio Nelson's decisive victory in the Battle of Trafalgar in 1805, but he bedeviled various alliances that were formed to stop him on land. The first coalition, which consisted of the United Kingdom, Spain, Austria, and Prussia, fell apart when Napoleon was able to force Prussia and Spain to capitulate and sign peace treaties with France. A second coalition, consisting of the United Kingdom, Austria, Russia, and the Ottoman Empire, quickly fell apart after Napoleon defeated all but Britain as well. By the beginning of the 19th century, Great Britain alone was left to fight against Napoleon Bonaparte. During this period, Prime Minister Pitt resigned and was replaced by Addington, and in 1802, the two nations signed a treaty of peace, the Treaty of Amiens, But King George III admittedly viewed the peace as an experiment. He suspected France would become ambitious once again, and war would resume, and in that he was right. It was not like Napoleon to sue for peace, but he had little choice in the matter at the time. Despite his victories, France was still debt-ridden and vulnerable, and Napoleon's position itself was far from secure. Napoleon's political maneuvering had secured him power, but it had also made him enemies on all sides, from Jacobins to Royalists, and he foiled two plots on his life in 1800. The last thing Napoleon wanted in 1803 was another protracted and expensive war, at least until he had been given time to revitalize France's finances. But he was given no choice. In May 1803, Britain declared war on France. When war resumed in 1803, the British Isles were consumed in fear, with many worrying that a full-scale invasion of the United Kingdom was highly possible. Some were uncertain that the famed British Royal Navy could successfully defend the nation from the French invasion, and for his part George III talked of leading his soldiers against any invasion. One member of his court noted that November, "The king is really prepared to take the field in case of attack. His beds are ready, and he can move at half an hour's warning." Meanwhile, George III privately wrote, "We are here in daily expectation that Bonaparte will attempt his threatened invasion. Should his troops effect a landing, I shall certainly put myself at the head of mine, and my other armed subjects, to repel them." The War of the Third Coalition pitted the United Kingdom against both France and Spain. During the prior war, Britain had been able to blockade French ports with relative ease, but it performed less spectacularly on the battlefields of France. Its supremacy was on the seas, while France's was decidedly on land. Trafalgar destroyed over half of the French fleet and resulted in the capture of 13,000 French sailors, dashing Napoleon's dream of an invasion across the English Channel. While Trafalgar represented a permanent setback for the French, it was not necessarily a bad thing that Napoleon was relegated to land-based campaigns, because Napoleon clearly excelled at them. And 6 weeks after the successful Ulm campaign against the Austrians, Napoleon scored one of his most legendary victories, the kind generals' dreams are made of, at the Battle of Austerlitz, where he faced a combined army of Russian and Austrian soldiers under the command of Tsar Alexander I and Holy Roman Emperor Francis II. To say the Battle of Austerlitz was a complete victory would be an understatement. It was one of the most important battles in European history. As a result of Napoleon's smashing victory, which resulted in the destruction of the coalition's army, the French would occupy Vienna in the coming months, force the disbanding of the Third Coalition, dissolve the Holy Roman Empire, and come to occupy much of the European continent. It was a dazzling success for Napoleon, one so great that it seems around this time that his hubris began to spiral out of control. According to some, he genuinely began to believe the legend of his invincibility, a mistake he would come to regret in later years. After Napoleon's victory over the Third Coalition, there was a year of relative peace in Europe, but it was little more than an illusion. The Peace of Pressburg, ratified after Austerlitz, technically held, but all the while the defeated members of the coalition were licking their wounds and massing their armies again in preparation for resuming the fight against the French. After barely a year, in 1806, Prussia and Russia, with support from several other minor European states, declared war on France. The Fourth Coalition may have been a formal alliance, but when the fighting started, the Russians were still too far away to support the Prussians, who were now faced with the prospect of opposing the French single-handedly. Napoleon acted quickly, striking out into modern Germany and defeating the Prussians at the battles of Jena-Auerstedt, another amazing victory that featured one French corps under Marshal Davout defeating the brunt of the Prussian army, an event that shocked even Napoleon. By the time the Russians could take the field, the Prussian army, which had once numbered nearly 250,000, was in tatters. When Napoleon entered Berlin in October 1806 and visited Frederick the Great's tomb, he remarked to his marshals, "If you were alive, we wouldn't be here today." Napoleon was now master of almost all of Western Europe, and his French Empire was at the height of its power. But Napoleon's longtime adversaries were still hoping to defeat him. Napoleon's woes were further compounded by his old enemies, the British. Even as Spain was rising, a British army, under the command of Sir Arthur Wellesley, the man who would later become the Duke of Wellington, landed in Portugal, and in a dashing display of soldiering that made even Napoleon sit up and take notice, proceeded to liberate the country from the French. Still, Napoleon stationed enough troops to keep Wellington occupied on the Iberian Peninsula while trying to invade Russia. Before George III permanently passed control of the throne over to his son as regent in 1811, he played a role in the political turmoil that ravaged the British government throughout the Napoleonic era. During the war years, Parliament had operated through a tenuous coalition of Tories and Whigs, both of whom attempted to jointly end the wars with France by negotiation. This, of course, failed time and again. Napoleon would have to be defeated militarily, not through peaceful negotiations. Throughout the Napoleonic Wars, Britain's political situation remained very fluid, and George III was right in the middle of the turmoil. With the addition of Ireland to the United Kingdom, a large population of Catholics was added to the kingdom, and Grenville wanted the Catholics to be allowed to serve as military officers in the Royal Navy. Grenville had figured that, in a time of war, Catholics ought to be used as best they could. But George III refused to provide his assent to this, and his relationship with Grenville and the Tory Whig coalition thus deteriorated. With the politics of the situation uncertain, George III took the prerogative and dissolved Parliament, ordering new elections in 1807. This was done at a time when the king was enormously popular, thanks in no small part to Nelson's success at Trafalgar in 1805. But he picked his moment properly, and the people were on his side regarding the issues of Catholics and the elections. Those elections went in his favor when the Tory party won decisively under the leadership of Lord Portland. This led to Portland's rise to the position of Prime Minister, with Grenville being dismissed, and the king now had a like-minded prime minister to work with. Chapter 8. Final Years. By 1810, George III was once again suffering from mental illness, and in his advanced age he was nearly blinded by cataracts and constantly in pain from rheumatism. When his youngest daughter, Princess Amelia, died, the king was so stricken with grief that one nurse reported, "The scenes of distress and crying every day were melancholy beyond description." Amelia's death precipitated yet another mental collapse on the part of King George, and this one would be his last. Around the time of his daughter's death, the king became disturbed when his urine changed colors and was frequently blue or green. After a few months, Queen Consort Charlotte was disconcertingly upset, having realized that her husband would never be cured of his illness, and doctors were at a loss for what to do. The king was removed to Windsor Castle in the countryside, so that the nation would not become aware of his utter insanity. This time, however, Parliament was immediately informed, and they relied upon the precedent of the king's previous mental collapse to appoint Prince George as regent again. The Regency Act of 1811 initially appointed the prince as regent, with some restrictions on his power, but these restrictions were lifted within a year, when it became abundantly clear that the king would never fully regain his sanity. George IV would serve as the regent for the remainder of his father's reign, and when he assumed the throne in 1820, little change was apparent. The Prince of Wales was essentially the king, for all intents and purposes, after the Regency Act of 1811. By 1814, George III was wholly incapacitated, and it is now assumed that he had a severe form of dementia. For example, that year the king was elevated to King of Hanover, not merely elector, when territorial changes upgraded and downgraded certain German principalities at the Congress of Vienna. The king had no idea and no rational response to the news, and seemed not to understand or appreciate the implications of the event at all. As regent, Prince George reversed many precedents set by his father, even while George III continued to be technically the king. This was especially so regarding the relationship between Parliament and the king. Under George III, Parliament had tried to assert control over issues like the appointment of the Prime Minister, but only with limited success. However, while George III had wanted to maintain royal power over Parliament as much as possible, the new regent had no such interest and was happy to let Parliament take over the government of the United Kingdom more than ever in the nation's history. When it came to the appointment of prime ministers, George IV let Parliament set a whole new precedent. That body, through a majority vote, would be responsible for deciding who would become prime minister. With that, much of the hard work George III had done to ensure the monarchy's power over Parliament was maintained was thus lost overnight. Changes in Parliament's relationship with the monarchy were not the only cultural and social changes ushered in during the regency of the Prince of Wales. In the arts, a new form of architecture began to spread throughout the United Kingdom and its realms overseas, which became fittingly known as the Regency style. It was characterized by relative simplicity, but with Greek and Roman style columns and arches to give a feeling of classical grandeur. George III's reign would close with the advent of an artistic style within his country that he had no control over. By 1818, George III's mental faculties had deteriorated so completely that he almost never uttered anything coherent. When his wife died that year, he remained unaware of it. Nevertheless, he continued to linger until 1820, thus spending nearly an entire decade as an invalid, one of the longest episodes of royal regency in British history. It's believed that George III was almost completely deaf by 1817, but it remains unclear because it might just have been that he appeared not to hear anything, simply because his brain no longer processed external stimuli. Whether he was actually deaf due to physical problems with his ears, deterioration in his mental state, or not deaf at all, continued to be debated by doctors. By the time of his death, the king's cataracts had left him almost completely blind as well. Today, some doctors think that the combined effects of blindness and possible deafness only worsened George III's mental state. His inability to take in any sort of sensory stimuli would have furthered his brain's deterioration, and at the time, some doctors considered conducting a very serious surgery on his eyes to remove the cataracts. Given George III's age and condition, however, the risky procedure was never undertaken. To treat the king's various conditions, opiates were frequently used. But given the hindsight of modern science, it's possible that treating him like that may have worsened his mental illness considerably. During Christmas 1819, the king reportedly spoke nothing but utter nonsense for nearly 24 hours straight, babbling on and on for so long that he eventually began to foam at the mouth. George III died about a month later, on January 29th, 1820, at Windsor Castle. Chapter 9. George III's Legacy. King George III's legacy is a decidedly mixed one. On the one hand, he's known principally as the Mad King and the King who lost America. On the other, the Battle of Trafalgar and his constant and sometimes successful wrangling with Parliament helped the Empire and the monarchy. Given the ups and downs, King George III's reign is often viewed as turbulently as the king himself was during his reign. In addition to being the Mad King who lost America, King George III was the longest-serving king in the history of the United Kingdom. He would later be displaced by Queen Victoria, and then again by Queen Elizabeth II, but he remains the third longest-serving monarch and the longest-serving king in the history of the United Kingdom. Naturally, the length of his reign meant many important changes occurred under his watch. For example, the roots of the Industrial Revolution and the rapid expansion of Britain's economic might took place under his reign, and by 1800 the United Kingdom was poised to become an industrial powerhouse. Relations with Parliament also solidified over the course of the king's reign. The manner in which the prime minister was appointed and the men who filled the post changed constantly under George III's reign, and many precedents were set regarding the position that remained today. For example, the majority party in Parliament appoints a prime minister, and if Parliament does not have a ruling majority, a hung Parliament, it becomes the monarch's prerogative to appoint for himself a prime minister. King George III's impact on British imperialism was perhaps his most lasting legacy, and not his finest so far as his subjects were concerned. Most notably, Britain lost the 13 North American colonies under his watch, a devastating blow to the prowess and breadth of the British Empire. The king, though, also set a long-lasting precedent regarding how to deal with the new United States, by welcoming the new country as a trading partner. Though the two nations would fight an inconclusive war from 1812 to 1814, the manner in which the Treaty of Paris was negotiated ultimately helped make them important allies. George III has often been remembered as a very devout man, so pious that he refused to take a mistress, and instilled as many religious values as he could into his family. However, this also had an effect on Ireland. The king was fiercely anti-Catholic, despite the protestations of his ministers in Parliament, who preferred to take a softer line on Catholicism in the interest of securing Irish loyalty. For a century after George III's reign, Ireland would prove to be an unruly addition to the United Kingdom, and, had he been less strict on the issue of Catholicism, perhaps Ireland would have remained a part of the United Kingdom, as Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland remain today. Many historians believe the religious issue sealed Ireland's fate. Even as George III struggled with the American colonies and Ireland, he was far more successful in dealing with the French. The beginning of his reign saw the successful prosecution of the Seven Years' War, and it was during his reign that Nelson prevented a French invasion at Trafalgar, and the seeds of Napoleon's defeat at Waterloo in 1815 were sown. By both weakening France and ensuring that it would never pose an existential threat to Great Britain, the ground was ultimately set for the two nations to eventually form an alliance over the subsequent decades. With so much time spent in power, successes and failures were likely inevitable, and George III clearly had a mixed legacy. Though he is remembered in America solely based on the Revolution, in Europe his legacy was not an entirely weak or negative one. George III was the longest-serving of what now is known as the Georgian period, and he was the most popular among those kings. For the length of his reign and his success vis-à-vis France, George III deserves much praise, and even his failings in America and Ireland offered the British a lesson about the difficulties of imperialist policies. This has been British Legends, The Life and Legacy of King George III, written by Charles River Editors, narrated by Bill Hare. Copyright 2014 by Charles River Editors. Production copyright 2017 by Charles River Editors.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.